8. If by this time Lamont had still felt he had something to lose professionally, he might have hesitated. Joshua Chen was universally unpopular, and anyone who dealt with him was in bad odor at once with almost every corner of the establishment. Chen was a one-man revolutionary whose single voice could somehow always be heard, because he brought to his causes an intensity that was utterly overpowering, and because he had built an organization that was more tightly knit than any ordinary political team in the world, as more than one politician was ready to swear. He had been one of the important factors accounting for the speed with which the pump had taken over the planet's energy needs. The pump's virtues were clear and obvious, as clear as non-pollution and as obvious as for free. Yet there might have been a longer rearguard fight by those who wanted nuclear energy, not because it was better, but because it had been the friend of their childhood. Yet when Chen beat his drums, the world listened just a little harder. Now he sat there, his broad cheekbones and round face bearing evidence of the approximately three-quarter admixture of Chinese ancestry. He said, "Let me get this straight. You're speaking only for yourself?" "Yes," said Lamont tightly. "Hallam doesn't back me. In fact, Hallam says I'm mad. Do you have to have Hallam's approval before you can move?" "I need no one's approval," said Chen with predictable arrogance. Then he lapsed back into thoughtful consideration. "You say the paramen are farther advanced in technology than we are?" Lamont had gone that far in the direction of compromise. He had avoided saying they were more intelligent. Farther advanced in technology was less offensive, but just as crude. "That is clear," said Lamont, "if only because they can send material across the gap between the universes and we can't." "Then why did they start the pump if it is dangerous? Why are they continuing it?" Lamont was learning to compromise in more than one direction. He might have said that Chen was not the first to ask this, but it would have sounded condescending, perhaps impatient, and he chose not to do so. Lamont said, "They were anxious to get started with something that was so apparently desirable as a source of energy, just as we were. I have reason to think they're as disturbed about it now as I am." "That's still your word. You have no definite evidence about their state of mind." "None that I can present at this moment." "Then it's not enough." "Can we afford to risk—" "It's not enough, Professor. There's no evidence. I haven't built my reputation by shooting down targets at random. My missiles have sped true to the mark every time because I knew what I was doing. But when I get the evidence, then I'll back you. If the evidence satisfies me, I assure you neither Hallam nor the Congress will be able to resist the tide. So get the evidence and come see me again." "But by then it will be too late." Chen shrugged. "Perhaps. Much more likely you will find that you were wrong and no evidence is to be had." "I'm not wrong." Lamont took a deep breath and said in a confidential tone, "Mr. Chen, there are very likely trillions upon trillions of inhabited planets in the universe, and among them there may be billions with intelligent life and highly developed technologies. The same is probably true of the para-universe. It must be that in the history of the two universes, there have been many pairs of worlds that came into contact and began pumping. There may be dozens or even hundreds of pumps scattered across junction points of the two universes." "Pure speculation. But if so, then it may be that in dozens or hundreds of cases, the mixture of natural law advanced locally to an extent sufficient to explode a planet's sun. The effect might have spread outward. The energy of a supernova added to the changing natural law may have set off explosions among neighboring stars, which in turn set off others. In time, perhaps an entire core of a galaxy or of a galactic arm will explode. But that is only imagination, of course." "Is it? There are hundreds of quasars in the universe, tiny bodies the size of several solar systems, but shining with the light of 100 full-size ordinary galaxies." You are telling me that the quasars are what are left of pumping planets? I'm suggesting that, in the century and a half since they were discovered, astronomers have still failed to account for their sources of energy. Nothing in this universe will account for it. Nothing. Doesn't it follow, then? What about the para-universe? Is it full of quasars, too? I wouldn't think so. Conditions are different there. Para-theory makes it seem quite definite that fusion takes place much more easily over there, so the stars must be considerably smaller than ours on the average. It would take a much smaller supply of easily fusing hydrogen to produce the energy our sun does. A supply as large as that of our sun would explode spontaneously. If our laws permeate the para-universe, hydrogen becomes a little more difficult to fuse. The para-stars begin to cool down. Well, that's not so bad, said Chen. They can use pumping to supply themselves with the necessary energy. By your speculations, they're in fine shape. Not really, said Lamont. Until now, he hadn't thought the para-situation through. Once our end explodes, the pumping stops. They can't keep it up without us, and that means they'll face a cooling star without pump energy. They might be worse off than we. We'd go out in a painless flash while their agony would be long drawn out. You have a good imagination, Professor, said Chen, but I'm not buying it. I don't see any chance of giving up pumping on nothing more than your imagination. Do you know what the pump means to mankind? It's not just the free, clean, and copious energy. Look beyond that. What it means is that mankind no longer has to work for a living. It means that for the first time in history, mankind can turn its collective brains to the more important problem of developing its true potential. For instance, not all the medical advances of 2.5 centuries have succeeded in advancing man's full lifespan much past 100 years. We've been told by gerontologists over and over that there is nothing, in theory, to stand in the way of human immortality. But so far, not enough attention has been concentrated on this. Lamont said angrily, Immortality! You're talking of pipe dreams! Perhaps you're a judge of pipe dreams, Professor, said Chen. But I intend to see that research into immortality begins. It won't begin if pumping ends. Then we are back to expensive energy, scarce energy, dirty energy. Earth's 2 billions will have to go back to work for a living, and the pipe dream of immortality will remain a pipe dream. It will anyway. No one is going to be immortal. No one is even going to live out a normal lifetime. Ah, but that is your theory only. Lamont weighed the possibilities and decided to gamble. Mr. Chen, a while ago I said I was not willing to explain my knowledge of the state of mind of the paramen. Well, let me try. We have been receiving messages. Yes, but can you interpret them? You received an English word. Chen frowned slightly. He suddenly put his hands in his pockets, stretched his short legs before him, and leaned back in his chair. And what was the English word? Fear. Lamont did not feel it necessary to mention the misspelling. Fear, repeated Chen. And what do you think it means? Isn't it clear that they're afraid of the pumping phenomenon? Not at all. If they were afraid, they would stop it. I think they're afraid all right, but they're afraid that our side will stop it. You've gotten across your intention to them, and if we stop it, as you want us to do, they've got to stop also. You said yourself they can't continue without us. It's a two-ended proposition. I don't blame them for being afraid. Lamont sat silent. I see, said Chen, that you haven't thought of that. Well, then, we'll push for immortality. I think that will be the more popular cause. Oh, popular causes, said Lamont slowly. I didn't understand what you found important. How old are you, Mr. Chen? For a moment, Chen blinked rapidly, then he turned away. He left the room, walking rapidly, with his hands clenched. Lamont looked up his biography later. Chen was 60, and his father had died at 62. But it didn't matter.